a prim and devout stepmother who advocated spiritual flagellation, and an abusive father, Sergeant Charles Mingus Sr., who simply handed out earthly whippings. Around the age of 6, Mingus began learning to play a Sears Roebuck trombone. Studies on the cello followed, and for a time Mingus performed with the Los Angeles Junior Philharmonic. Lloyd Reese, who trained 2 generations of Southern California's finest jazz talent, helped transform the youngster from a classical cellist into a jazz bassist. His efforts were supplemented by other teachers, including jazz bassist Red Callender and classical bassist Herman Reinshagen. With diligent practice and a clear goal to be the world's greatest on his instrument, Mingus developed quickly into a solid player in a Jimmy Blanton mold. From the start, composition also fascinated Mingus. While still a teenager, he wrote Half-Mast Inhibition and The Chill of Death, works he proudly revived and recorded decades later. He learned traditional jazz at the source, gigging with Kid Ory in 1942 and Louis Armstrong in 1943. His late initiation into the world of bop came oddly when he joined an L.A. band of white would-be boppers, including Parker's most fanatical disciple, Dean Benedetti, who later gave up performing to trail Parker from gig to gig, a portable recording device in tow, aiming to capture the altoist's solos for posterity. In time, Mingus was jamming with Byrd and immersing himself in modern jazz. Yet his early recordings show that other jazz styles continue to be a source of inspiration. Tracing a lineage through these efforts is not easy. The shadow of Ellington looms over many early recordings and would never entirely be absent from Mingus's music. His trio work with Red Norvell and Tal Farlow from the early 1950s was, in contrast, bop of the highest order. Mingus's ensuing projects for the debut label also included noteworthy modern jazz sessions, but of a much different flavor, especially on the dazzling Massey Hall concert recording with Parker, Gillespie, Roach, and Powell. These efforts coexisted with a series of involvements with various cool players ranging from Getz to Tristano. Indeed, the cool style for a time seemed like it might become a decisive influence. The bassist's 1954 Jazzical Moods, for example, reveals a cerebral and restrained Mingus very much at odds with a hot-blooded extrovert of a few years later. But it was not until the late 1950s that these different allegiances began to be subsumed into a more distinct personal style. These years constituted a prolific and exceptionally creative period for Mingus, as documented by a number of outstanding projects, including Pithecanthropus Erectus from 1956, Tijuana Moods, East Coasting, and The Clown from 1957, and Blues and Roots and Mingus Ah-Um from 1959. Some of Mingus's finest music from this period was not released at the time. As a result, his impact on the jazz world of the late 1950s may have been diluted compared to what it might otherwise have been. Yet viewed cumulatively, Mingus's efforts from the era represent landmark accomplishments. His mature style had now blossomed into full-fledged artistry and was evident in the music's exuberance, its excesses, its delight in the combination of opposites. Here the vulgar rubs shoulders with royalty. A stately melody is bent out of shape by sassy counterpoint lines. A lilting 6-8 rhythm is juxtaposed against a roller coaster double time 4-4. The 12-bar blues degenerates into semi-anarchy. Tempos and moods shift, sometimes violently. As a jazz composer, Mingus is often lauded for his formalist tendencies, for the novel structures of his works. Yet just as pointedly, these are pieces stuffed to the brim with content. Even the name Jazz Workshop, which Mingus favored for his bands, evokes this image. The impulses of the moment are primary. Compositional structures change and adapt to meet the dictates of the here and now. The rough-edged counterpoint that sometimes takes over Mingus's most characteristic music, a surreal evocation of Dixieland, often makes his approach sound like a subversive type of anti-composition. Fans had at least one guarantee. Mingus's work never was boring. A visceral excitement radiated from the bandstand at his performances and lives on in his recordings. Pieces such as Better Get It In Your Soul, Jelly Roll, and Wednesday Night Prayer Meeting may recall the jazz tradition, but do so in a way that is tellingly alive, that could never be reduced to notes on a page. Hence, it comes as little surprise that Mingus delighted in teaching his pieces by ear. Wednesday Night Prayer Meeting bore an all-too-fitting title. Mingus's music was an oral equivalent of the sanctified church, delighting in a loosely structured give-and-take, electrified with evangelical zeal. This was a musical speaking in tongues, accompanied by hand clapping, shouts, exhortations, improvised narrative, and other spontaneous outbursts. Yet these unpredictable elements of a Mingus performance also had their dark side. There were songs cut short in mid-flow, sidemen fired and rehired on the bandstand, denigrating asides and intemperate outbursts. With Mingus, whether on stage or off, even the moments of gentle introspection often merely marked a deceptive quiet before the storm. Mingus was increasingly returning to the early roots of jazz music during this period. As with his idol Ellington, Mingus found the 12-bar blues to be an especially fertile departure point. While most jazz musicians typically treat the blues form as a generic set of blowing changes, Mingus transformed the 12-bar choruses into true compositions. Only a handful of jazz artists, Ellington, Morton, Monk, were his equal in this regard. Mingus's Haitian Fight Song was an early indication of this approach, with Pussycat Doos and Goodbye Pork Pie Hat from Mingus A-Um standing out as especially brilliant examples, the latter following a 12-bar form that evokes a minor blues while deviating far from the standard progressions. All in all, Mingus's 1959 recordings for Columbia present some of the most fully realized works of his career. But once again, the label hid Mingus's light under a bushel, holding on to much of this material and releasing it in piecemeal fashion over a period of many years. The early 1960s found Mingus standing on the outside of the free jazz clique, staring at it with a mixture of curiosity, envy, and disdain. Mingus's roots in the jazz tradition and his impulses as a composer prevented him from fully accepting atonality and open structures. Yet his fondness for new sounds motivated him to find some common ground with the avant-garde movement. His group with Eric Dolphy from this period was one of the most daring of his career, and the band is in especially fine form on a live recording made at the 1960 Antibes Jazz Festival and on the release Charles Mingus Presents Charles Mingus. What Love, an early Mingus composition revived during this period, in part because Dolphy noted its similarity to Ornette Coleman's work, exhibits the bassist engaging in intricate free-form dialogues with Dolphy's bass clarinet. The piece is loosely based on What Is This Thing Called Love, but the deconstruction is so complete that even composer Cole Porter may have failed to recognize the linkage. The traditional side of Mingus's music resurfaced the following year when his band featured for 3 months multi-reed player Roland Kirk, later known as Rasan Roland Kirk. Kirk was an ideal sideman for Mingus. A stellar soloist, he could play with authenticity and forcefulness in any jazz style, from trad to free, and on a host of instruments, not just conventional saxes and clarinets, but pawn shop oddities such as manzello, stritch, siren whistle, and nose flute. Kirk's arsenal of effects was seemingly endless, ranging from circular breathing to playing three horns at once. This versatility came, in time, to be a curse. Had he focused on a single instrument, he would have been acknowledged as a master. Instead, he was too often dismissed as little more than a jazz novelty act. While with Mingus, Kirk invigorated the 1961 Oh Yeah release with a handful of penetrating solos, including an extraordinary old-timey outing on Eat That Chicken. A dozen years later, Kirk rejoined Mingus for a Carnegie Hall concert and stole the show with his sly maneuvering inside and outside the chord changes. The small body of recordings featuring these two jazz masters in tandem is a cause for much idle speculation as to what might have been had they collaborated more often. Mingus's recordings for the Impulse label in the early 1960s continued to find him in top form. His 1963 The Black Saint and the Sinner Lady stands out as his strongest and most structured extended piece. Mingus apparently composed many of his works in snippets, with some of the bits and pieces, such as the bridge on his early Eulogy for Rudy Williams, showing up in several different efforts. With The Black Saint and the Sinner Lady, Mingus was able to fine-tune the composition after it was recorded, using splices and overdubs, to create a more unified artistic statement. Not all of Mingus's efforts from this period held together so well. His 1962 Town Hall concert is most often remembered as one of the great fiascos in the history of jazz. Scores were still uncompleted at curtain time, with two copyists continuing to work after the curtain was raised. Years later, Günther Schuller would struggle valiantly to realize Mingus's original vision for the Town Hall concert, but despite his best efforts, the music remained a series of fragments, only loosely tied together. This is no criticism of Mingus. Fragmentation was a recurring curse as well as a blessing of the 20th century. After all, this was an age that began with physicists contending that continuity was merely a statistical illusion, a premise that artists of all sorts quickly embraced. "These fragments I have shored against my ruins," Eliot proclaims toward the end of The Wasteland. "I cannot make it cohere," announces Ezra Pound near the conclusion of his massive Kantos. These assertions, with their measured fatalism, could stand as mottos for the modernist agenda in jazz as well. In fact, Mingus was the closest jazz has come to having its own Ezra Pound. And, as with Pound, Mingus's life too often mimicked the dissolution of his art. Psychological troubles plagued him throughout his career. In 1958, Mingus even tried to refer himself to the Bellevue Mental Hospital. In naive fashion, he had knocked on the door. Looking only for counsel, he soon found himself confined. This was the same man who enlisted his analyst to write liner notes, and who named a song, "All the Things You Could Be By Now If Sigmund Freud's Wife Was Your Mother." The 1960s were tumultuous years for the bassist. Before the town hall concert, Mingus's temper exploded during a meeting with trombonist Jimmy Nepper, who was working as a copyist. Mingus punched Nepper, who eventually took him to court on assault charges. The most memorable moment from the documentary Mingus, filmed in 1966, was not of music making, but of the movie's subject being evicted from his apartment for non-payment of rent. When the Mingus at Montgomery recording was released a short while later, it included a personal note from the bassist, soliciting donations to compensate for the misfortunes I have suffered. But such was the instability in Mingus's life that, by the time the record hit the stores, he could no longer be reached at the post office box listed in the liner notes. By the close of the 1960s, Mingus was barely visible in the jazz world, performing rarely, recording not at all. It comes as little surprise that Mingus had such trouble summing up his chaotic life in a proposed autobiography. When a publisher contracted him to write his life story, Mingus intimated that he was putting together a 1,500-page manuscript. When Beneath the Underdog finally appeared in 1971, it was only a fraction of that length. And those looking for a point-by-point exposition of Mingus's career as a musician were likely to be disappointed by the text. Musical activities play a subsidiary role in the proceedings. Instead, the work is a patchwork of braggadocio, real or fantasized sexual exploits, pop psychology, fanciful dialogue, and odd anecdotes. Mingus the man, like his alter ego the musician, appeared to be an accumulation of the most disparate fragments. All the same, the book makes for compelling reading, brimming with excesses, even in its abbreviated state. On the heels of this literary effort, Mingus saw his musical career rejuvenated. He signed with Columbia and, in a telling irony, recorded The Chill of Death, a piece that the same label had shelved back in 1947. Mingus's 1970s band, with saxophonist George Adams and pianist Don Pullen, joined by longtime Mingus drummer Danny Richmond, was a powerful unit that could hold up under the inevitable comparisons with earlier jazz workshop ensembles. This was also one of the most energized bands Mingus had ever fronted. Pullen's slashing piano style combined dissonant tone clusters, percussive chords, and biting single-note lines. Adams's tenor offered a sheets-of-sound approach analogous to Coltrane's. Both were capable of playing inside or outside of the structural foundations Mingus laid down on the bass. This band is well represented on a series of recordings for the Atlantic label, including Mingus Moves, Cumbia and Jazz Fusion, and the two volumes of Changes. Mingus's compositional skills continued to shine in diverse works, ranging from the constantly shifting Sue's Changes to the unabashedly traditional swing ballad Duke Ellington's Sound of Love. Three or Four Shades of Blue from 1977 found Mingus joined by electric guitar and leaning ever so coyly in the direction of jazz rock fusion. Mingus was reportedly upset at the label for pushing his music in a commercial direction, but softened his criticism after the release turned out to be the biggest seller of his career. Around this time, Mingus sought medical treatment for a recurring pain in his legs. When in public, he could be seen using a cane. Toward the end of 1977, the doctors diagnosed amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, known more commonly as Lou Gehrig's disease, a humbling disorder marked by a gradual loss of coordination and mastery over one's body. Mingus continued to compose, singing into a tape recorder when he no longer had control over his fingers. He initiated projects, including one with pop diva Joni Mitchell, that he did not live long enough to see through to completion. In his final days, Mingus was feted as became a jazz legend. His 56th birthday was celebrated with a performance of his Revelations by the New York Philharmonic. A few weeks later, he appeared at the White House as part of an all-star gathering of jazz musicians during the Jimmy Carter administration. His last days were spent pursuing alternative medical therapies in Mexico, where he died in Cuernavaca on January 5, 1979. His music continued to flourish posthumously. The Joni Mitchell tribute recording Mingus came out a short while after his death, introducing the bassist's music to legions of new fans. A tribute band featuring former sidemen performed under the name Mingus Dynasty, while a similar continuation of the bassist's influence was seen in a combo led by George Adams and Don Pullen. And over a decade after his passing, Mingus's unwieldy two-hour-long epitaph, drawn from the music of the 1962 Town Hall concert described above, was pieced together by Günther Schuller and performed and recorded to much fanfare. In these transition years for jazz, only Miles Davis challenged Mingus in continually redefining the modern jazz combo vocabulary while still keeping a distance, often only a small distance, from the more extreme implications of free jazz. Davis, like Mingus, was able to borrow judiciously from Ornette Coleman, but with results that were never merely imitative. On such classic recordings as ESP, Miles Smiles, and Nefertiti, Davis and Wayne Shorter succeeded brilliantly in creating a more tonally centered counterpoint to Coleman and Cherry, much as Eric Dolphy had done with Mingus, or alongside Booker Little on the seminal five-spot performances. Here one finds the same haunting vocal quality to the horns, the free-floating rhythms, the indirect manner of phrasing, lethargic and biting by turns. The sense of freedom is so pervasive that the robust harmonic structures underlying the music pass by almost unnoticed. Many listeners have, no doubt, heard these Davis performances and surmised that there were no set chord changes or patterns dictating the flow of the music. In fact, this music was much more tightly structured than it sounds at first hearing. The compositions of Davis and Shorter, masterful exercises in subtlety, were a major factor in this achievement. But the essence of this music lay ultimately in its multi-layered rhythmic motion, an enlivening and unconfined energy that was just as evident when the band was playing familiar standards as in the more attenuated compositions of the group's members. In this regard, the interaction of pianist Herbie Hancock, bassist Ron Carter, and drummer Tony Williams was critical in defining the band's sound. In time, this unit would demand respect as the premier rhythm section of its day, and one of the finest that the jazz world has ever produced. It built on the Bill Evans, Scott LaFaro, Paul Motion Trio work from the early 1960s, emulating the latter's celebration of the internalized beat, but with more assertiveness, a harder edge, and a more overt sense of forward momentum. Behind all this lay Davis's foresight in selecting the three rhythm players, each of them relative newcomers to the New York scene at the time they joined his band. Herbie Hancock had spent his formative years in Chicago, where he was born in 1940. During his teens, he served as a sideman with visiting jazz stars and performed with his own groups. After graduating from Grinnell College in 1960, Hancock came to New York as a member of trumpeter Donald Byrd's band. In May 1962, just 12 months before joining Davis, Hancock made his first album as a leader, Taken Off, for the Blue Note label. Although this release featured Hancock's funk composition Watermelon Man, destined to become a crossover hit, the project gave only the barest hints of the flair and cogency the pianist would manifest with the Davis band, as well as on three superb later Blue Note recordings, Maiden Voyage, Empyrean Isles, and Speak Like a Child. Each of these releases broke new ground and showed a different side of this restless visionary at the keyboard. Indeed, few jazz artists would expand their musical horizons during the 1960s with more persistence than Hancock, a path of growth and development in which his stint with Miles was just one more stopping point. Yet, through it all, certain trademark elements of his style stayed constant, notably his creative improv work, clarity of rhythmic expression, and taut compositional structures. Ron Carter was in his late 20s when he joined Davis, but his resume in the jazz world was fairly brief at the time, since most of Carter's training had been in classical music. Until his late teens, Carter had focused his energies on the cello. Perceiving that racial prejudice would make it difficult to pursue a symphonic career, Carter switched his emphasis to the double bass, but even then continued to study and perform the classical repertoire. After completing studies at the Eastman School in 1959, Carter worked with Chico Hamilton, Thelonious Monk, and Cannonball Adderley, and recorded with Eric Dolphy, Jackie Byard, Randy Weston, and Don Ellis, among others. These engagements paved the way to Carter's five-year stint with Davis beginning in 1963. A skilled technician, versatile section mate, and solid soloist, Carter would come to be the most in-demand bassist of his generation, eventually appearing as sideman on more than 2,000 recordings, as well as leader at more than 50 sessions. These two recent arrivals in New York scene were, however, seasoned professionals in comparison with Davis's choice for drummer. Tony Williams was only 17 years old when he joined Davis in May 1963, just a few months after having moved to New York at Jackie McLean's behest. Williams was so young that Davis faced problems with authorities when he was booked to play in nightclubs where minors were not allowed. But Williams compensated for his lack of professional experience with an abundance of power, passion, and creativity. One could make the case that no other percussionist in the history of jazz ever played so well, so young. In other settings, Williams might have dominated the proceedings, driving the band with his unbridled energy. But this Davis unit demanded different skills. Along with Hancock and Carter, Williams engaged in a complex polyrhythmic dialogue, a cat-and-mouse game in running meter. This was, for the most part, a music of implication, a path half-hidden in the underbrush, not a paved two-lane highway. True, at appropriate moments, Williams could and would kick the Davis combo into a steady groove, but these outbursts were especially effective because they came in the context of the more open and unfettered sound typically favored by the quintet. On the surface, it appeared as if Davis's mid-1960s band led two separate lives. The studio recordings revealed a pioneering unit performing quasi-abstract original compositions, whose musical iconoclasm bordered on the avant-garde. Yet in concert, Davis continued to program the same ballads and popular standards, Stella by Starlight, My Funny Valentine, as well as 1950s jazz originals, often blues-based, such as Walkin' or All Blues, that had been in his repertoire for years, despite his sideman's desire to play the newer material in front of audiences. But this duality was only superficial. In performance, the Davis Band played the old songs with such experimental zeal that no one could have accused the band members of harboring the slightest tinge of nostalgia or conservatism. Any lingering sentimentality was being squeezed out of these pieces. The tempos were getting faster and faster, and the band's interpretations more daring and unpredictable. We are fortunate that this combo was so well documented in performance. Its recorded legacy includes memorable concerts in Europe and Japan, and more than 7 hours of ardent music-making captured at Chicago's Plugged Nickel in December 1965. In total, this body of work encompasses some of the most vital reworkings of the jazz standard repertoire from any era. The influence of this Davis unit would linger long. Its sound hovers behind the scenes in the music made by Wynton Marsalis early in his career and by other young traditionalists during the closing years of the century and into the new millennium. The release of the complete Plugged Nickel recordings, some 3 decades after they were taped, reinforced how fresh and contemporary Davis's music still sounded, despite a whole generation of passing jazz fads and fashions. Yet Davis himself, at the very moment he had reached the pinnacle of mainstream jazz, was anxious to explore newer approaches. Around this time, the trumpeter began listening to the music of James Brown, Jimi Hendrix, Sly and the Family Stone, Muddy Waters, and other artists with only peripheral ties to the jazz world. His own music was now evolving in response to these new influences. The big break with the past would come with his seminal Bitches Brew release of 1969. But even before that seismic shift, the signs of this coming change could be seen in his growing use of electric instruments and vamp forms. Sessions from late 1967 and early 1968 find Davis experimenting with the addition of electric guitar, played by George Benson or Joe Beck. During the same period, Hancock began using an electric piano on some tracks. By the time of Fuji do Kilimanjaro, recorded during June and September 1968, the multi-layered textures of the earlier quintet releases were increasingly replaced by more insistent ground rhythms. With In a Silent Way from the following February, the change was all but complete. The band's sound now tended toward uncomplicated patterns reminiscent of the dance and soul music of the day. The harmonies were often static. To cement this change, Davis was enlisting the skills of a wider range of musicians, including keyboardists Joe Zawinul and Chick Corea, guitarist John McLaughlin, and bassist Dave Holland. Within a few months, the last fading elements of the mid-1960s band were purged in favor of the more overtly rock-oriented approach celebrated in Bitches Brew. This release, lamented by many of Davis's older fans, would attract a younger audience to his music and earn the trumpeter the first gold record of his career. In time, this style came to be known as jazz rock fusion, or more simply, fusion. For the next decade, this sound would exert a powerful influence on the jazz world, with a host of former Davis sidemen using it as a foundation to promote their own careers. But for all its commercial success, fusion failed to establish itself as a dominant style. By the close of these transition years, the jazz idiom had become too fragmented to embrace any one approach as representative of the age, as swing and bop had tended to do in earlier decades. Instead, a smorgasbord of sounds, a range of possibilities, prevailed. The most pressing alternative to the fusion style during this period would come at the opposite end of the spectrum. Free jazz was virtually its mirror image. If the one style was a path to financial success, the other represented economic isolation. If one style was tied to commerce and the music industry, the other thumbed its nose at these same forces. If the one style reflected a return to simpler, dance-like musical structures, akin to what jazz had done during the big band era, the other preferred to subvert structures in whole or in part. One style espoused pragmatism, the other progressivism. The jazz magazines of the day rarely talked about a battle between free and fusion styles, as they had years earlier in the days when traditional and modern forms had engaged in an ongoing war of words and, occasionally, horns. But this may have been only because the chasm between the two styles was too wide to admit any common ground. Then again, perhaps it was only that, by this time, the fragmentation of jazz styles had become so much a part of the musical landscape that it was accepted as an inexorable fact. And though many of the proponents of free jazz saw their music as a logical development, evolving clearly from the music's history to date, the obvious next thing in a history of next things that could be traced back to Buddy Bolden, others remained unconvinced. For them, a clear progression to a new dominant style, an unambiguous linear development in the history of the music, the ascendancy of one more advanced and liberated jazz language, was very much in doubt. For still others, as would become clear with a new traditionalism of the 1980s and 1990s, a return to earlier styles of jazz, whether in the guise of New Orleans Back to Basics, Duke Ellington's Visionary Moods, Miles's mid-1960s aesthetic, or other strands of the music's heritage, would come to emerge as a beguiling option, a comforting way of regaining this lost sense of unity, and even then perhaps only achieving a symbolic wholeness. Yet the true heir of the jazz mantle, as subsequent events proved, would be neither free nor fusion, a return to roots or a celebration of rock and rap. Instead, there was merely an exemplary splintering, a disintegration into isolated modules. Chapter 8. Freedom and Fusion. Free Jazz. Freedom stood out as a politically charged word in American public discourse during the late 1950s and early 1960s. It would be hard, in fact, to find a term more explosive, more laden with depths of meaning, or proclaimed with more emotion during these tumultuous years. This truism of civics classes and refrain from the nation's founding documents now took on new force, in the process outlining a sharp divide in the country's social and economic structures. The civil rights movement of the day raised it aloft as a battle cry, held it forth as a goal, and asserted it as a first principle on which all else depended. It could no longer be put out of the mind as an empty phrase or accepted as a fait accompli in American society. Freedom was very much something to live for a few, even to die for. The Brown versus Board of Education decisions of the mid-1950s, which were critical in reversing a long history of racial segregation in American schools, were not, as some may have suspected at the time, closing chapters of a struggle for racial equality that had raged since before the Emancipation Proclamation. Instead, these moves to integrate public institutions set off a chain of reverberations throughout American society, re-energizing the civil rights movement and setting the stage for a series of confrontations in which the quest for freedom would figure as a repeated motif. Freedom riders defied segregation in buses and terminals in the Deep South, often at great personal risk. The Freedom Vote of 1963 attracted tens of thousands of participants to mock elections that demonstrated the absence of real representative democracy in the South. The Freedom Summer of the following year found activists organizing to register African American voters in large numbers in anticipation of the fall presidential election. The Freedom Singers Chorus toured the country, giving concerts and raising money for civil rights advocacy. Black leaders sought to form freedom schools and establish a Freedom Democratic Party. The word was imprinted on the public's consciousness, dramatized in speeches by Dr. Martin Luther King, sung in hymns, brandished at Little Rock, Birmingham, Selma, and other battlegrounds in the fight for equality. It is impossible to comprehend the free jazz movement of these same years without understanding how it fed upon this powerful cultural shift in American society. Its practitioners advocated much more than freedom from harmonic structures or compositional forms, although that too was an essential part of their vision of jazz. Many of them saw their music as inherently political. They believed that they could, indeed must, choose between participating in the existing structures, in society, in the entertainment industry, in the jazz world, or rebelling against them. The aesthetic could no longer be isolated from these cultural currents. In the overheated Marxist rhetoric that increasingly found its way into mainstream political debate during those days, even a pure art, such as music, was ultimately part of a superstructure of social institutions and events that was delineated and determined by economic realities and, ultimately, class values. Pure music? One was advised that such abstractions were, at best, an idle delusion, at worst, a conscious deception. An undercurrent of political advocacy had always existed in the jazz world, but now it exploded on the surface as never before. Amiri Baraka, then writing under the name Leroy Jones, declared in his 1963 book Blues People that the new music signified more radical changes and reevaluations of social and emotional attitudes toward the general environment. Critic Frank Kofsky took this view further, asserting that the free jazz movement represented nothing less than a vote of no confidence in Western civilization and the American dream. In the 1964 U.S. election, Kofsky even wrote in John Coltrane's name on his ballot as his choice for vice president, alongside Malcolm X as his pick for president, a strange ticket only for those unaware of the larger symbolic resonance of progressive jazz currents during this period. This overt linking of free jazz and sociopolitical criticism went so far that Eckhard Jost, a historian of the movement, lamented that the autonomous musical aspects of the evolution of free jazz, that is, those aspects which escape a purely sociological analysis, often were ignored. The music risked being relegated to a secondary utilitarian role, valued for what it advocated rather than how it actually sounded. In truth, the socio-political ramifications of this music remained, in many ways, decisive in distinguishing the new free jazz players from the older generation of experimental jazz performers. From a purely musical point of view, freedom or atonality in jazz music had appeared many years before Ornette Coleman and Cecil Taylor raised it to a decisive issue. Lenny Tristano had experimented with free techniques in a series of pieces, Intuition, Digression, Descent into the Maelstrom, some of them dating back to the late 1940s. Bob Gretinger's writings for the Stan Kenton Band, most notably his 1948 magnum opus City of Glass, were uncompromising works that defied the conventions of existing jazz harmonic and melodic techniques, as was Jimmy Giuffre's 1953 recording of Fugue. Contemporary classical composers were also attempting to use jazz instrumentation to explore avant-garde techniques, as in Stravinsky's Ebony Concerto, 1946, or Milton Babbitt's All Set, 1957. Sensing the potential of these various trends, Günther Schuller, who had composed Atonal Studies for Jazz in 1948 and, at the start of the 1950s, was playing with Miles Davis's Nonet and composing 12-tone row works, coined the term third stream in 1957 to describe a merging of the most promising and progressive currents in jazz and contemporary classical music. But each of these precursors of free jazz was white, and each was, to a greater or lesser extent, representative of the established order of things. The proponents of free jazz who came into prominence at the close of the 1950s were, in contrast, almost all outsiders. As African Americans, they were outsiders from mainstream society. As musical renegades, they were outsiders from mainstream jazz. For many years, they lacked access to concert halls, grants, prestigious commissions, and other time-honored measures of artistic achievement. During his formative years in Los Angeles, free jazz pioneer Ornette Coleman worked as an elevator operator in the department store. Pianist Cecil Taylor labored as a dishwasher even after he achieved notoriety in the jazz world, rather than pursue more overtly commercial musical projects. The third stream movement had offered atonality with a smiling face, dressed up in top hat and tails. The major exponents of free jazz, in contrast, tended to represent an outgrowth of the bohemians and angry young men of the 1950s. They emerged despite the established order and were all too aware of that fact. The parallels with the rise of bebop are striking. In the late 1930s, as in the late 1950s, many established jazz stars were pushing the music forward and adopting new concepts in shaping the sound and style of their work. But in both instances, it was not the progressives of the older generation who succeeded in transforming the music. Instead, it was a group of younger, largely unheralded musicians who rocked the foundations, tore down the existing structures, and built afresh with formidable new materials. In retrospect, we can trace the moves that made free jazz possible in the 1950s works of Coltrane, Dolphy, Mingus, Tristano, Jufri, Davis, and others. But it took Ornette Coleman, Cecil Taylor, Albert Ayler, and other new arrivals on the scene to make a musical revolution. In the process, they forced many of the older players to dance to their tune. Coltrane and Dolphy were still playing tonal music when Ornette arrived on the New York scene, but before long, both were pushing the limits of their music. Sonny Rollins, the other iconic young tenor of the era, also showed his comprehension of the changes afoot in the jazz world, first by choosing to retire from the scene to study and practice, and later, after returning, by hiring several of Coleman's former sidemen. Even Miles Davis, who had derided Coleman in the late 1950s, hell, just listen to what he writes and how he plays, the man is all screwed up inside, came to be influenced by the new sound in the mid-1960s, forging a two-horn sound with Wayne Shorter that bore an uncanny resemblance to the Don Cherry-Ornette Coleman collaborations. Coltrane, Dolphy, Rollins, Miles. To see these masters of mainstream jazz not only acknowledge the new music, but strive to emulate it, this marked an extraordinary change in the jazz world. This shift was all the more stunning when one considers how little respect Coleman had received just a short while before his rise to fame. When Ornette had attempted to sit in with name bands, Dexter Gordon's, the Brown Roach Quintet, and others, he had almost always been subjected to derision and ridicule, sometimes ordered to leave the stage. In other instances, the musicians simply began packing up their instruments while he was still playing. But this response was mild compared to the night in Baton Rouge, some years before, when a Coleman tenor solo had stopped the dancers in their tracks and roused an unruly gang. A half-dozen thugs cornered the saxophonist outside, beat him until he passed out, and threw his saxophone into the street. For almost a decade afterward, Coleman hesitated to play the tenor again. He sensed some potential for bad karma in the horn, and decided to focus his energies on the alto instead. Years before, Charlie Parker had suffered a painful initiation into musical maturity when he was laughed off the bandstand during a Kansas City session. But Coleman's formative years were even more tainted by humiliation and rejection. Indeed, no major figure in the history of jazz has had a less propitious early career. Coleman was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas, during the heart of the Great Depression. These were difficult years. Coleman's father scuffled, finding what work he could as a cook, mechanic, and construction worker, among other pursuits. Ornette's mother worked as a clerk in a funeral home and sold Avon-type products on the side. But these were also fecund years for African-American music in the Lone Star State. Dozens of top-notch bands worked the territory, firing the ambitions and nurturing the talents of numerous future jazz stars. Boogie-woogie piano flourished. During this period, some simply called it Texas piano or fast Texas piano. Similarly, a blues-drenched tenor sax style was an ever-present ingredient in the jazz and popular music of the day, in time coming to be known as Texas tenor. A host of saxophonists, either born or raised in Texas, such as Arnett Cobb, 1918 to 1989, Illinois Jacquet, 1922 to 2004, David Fathead Newman, 1933 to 2009, and Buddy Tate, 1913 to 2001, exemplified this sound in their gritty, soulful playing, defining an approach that permeated the local jazz scene during Coleman's formative years. It is unclear how much of this music was heard by Coleman at the time. By his own admission, church songs and big band recordings made a stronger impression on him, at least at first. But the pronounced blues sensibility that recurs in his later work, rooting it in the black tradition even as it broke new ground, suggests that the various indigenous styles eventually found a place in his personal aesthetic vision. Honkin', shoutin', riffin', riding high on a single note or barking out a guttural howl, this Texas saxophone heritage lingers in the background, like the Jungian archetype of a primal jazz style, sometimes rising to the surface at the least expected moments in Coleman's mature oeuvre. During his early teens, Coleman acquired an alto saxophone but struggled in his attempts to learn the rudiments of the horn. Confusing the alphabet and musical scale, he determined incorrectly that the concert scale began with A rather than, as it does, with C. Coleman slowly, painstakingly gained a basic education in music, but with many setbacks along the way. Joining a church band, Coleman was ridiculed for his lack of training. A much-anticipated lesson with Walter Foots Thomas, a journeyman jazz player, provided little guidance or encouragement. The veteran simply had Coleman play for an hour while looking in the mirror, so that Ornette would quit making faces while he blew the horn. A short while later, Coleman was thrown out of his high school marching band, ostensibly for mixing swing and sousa, an unacceptable combination in the minds of the powers that be. His early professional career was equally marked by ups and downs. One bandleader, Coleman claimed, even got to the point of paying him not to play. In the face of these obstacles, Coleman persevered and continued to develop and grow as a musician. The miracle was that he did this without abandoning his own personal approach to improvisation, despite the constant negative feedback. He could play the blues, an early employer recalls, but he didn't want to. In time, Coleman developed an equally complex relationship to the bebop idiom. He listened to bebop, studied it, learned the tunes, performed them, yet the end result retained a certain foreignness, just as his blues work had done during his Texas years. Amateur recordings made of Coleman at the Hillcrest Club in Los Angeles shortly before his rise to fame fortuitously captured this odd hybrid on tape. Playing Charlie Parker's Klaktoveed Sedstein, Coleman echoes the composer's astringent sound and phrasing, yet his choice of notes and cadences veers far from the expected path. It almost seems as if Coleman has taken the modern jazz vocabulary and translated it into a new tongue, some private Esperanto of his own creation. Certainly the animating force in this music comes not from Parker, but from Coleman's singular take on it. The Hillcrest engagement also represented a rare occasion for Coleman to work with a group of like-minded musicians. Trumpeter Don Cherry, unlike Coleman, had earned the respect of local Southern California players for his bop prowess. Along with Billy Higgins, the drummer on the Hillcrest gig, Cherry had played in the Jazz Messiahs, an up-and-coming local modern jazz band, and had graced the stage at high-profile clubs such as The Hague and The Lighthouse. Like many others, Cherry was originally put off by the eccentric Coleman. Of his first meeting, he recalled, "He had long hair and a beard. It was about 90 degrees, and he had on an overcoat. I was scared of him." But soon grew fascinated with Coleman's unconventional compositions and improvisations. Cherry would later share Coleman's rise to fame, developing his own range of odd behavior patterns in the process. For a time, he favored performing on a pocket cornet, called a pocket trumpet by Cherry, to complement Coleman's plastic alto, quasi-toy instruments used to fight a musical revolution. Bassist Charlie Hayden was an anchor both musically and personally to the horns. Bespeckled, owlish, Hayden looked the part of an apprentice clerk in a bank, but his bass line subverted the image. They captured a piquant meeting ground between consonance and dissonance, powered the band with a rock-solid beat, and softened the hard edge of this freedom music with a sweet, warm tone. Paul Blay, the pianist and nominal leader of the Hillcrest Band, would stay with Coleman for only a short while, but would make his own mark on free jazz in later years. In a series of seminal recordings, Footloose, Mr. Joy, The Floater Syndrome, Open, To Love, Blay demonstrated a masterful conception of solo and combo playing, distinguished by a rare sensitivity to space and time, tone, and texture. Coleman's persistence, aided by a referral from bassist Red Mitchell, led to an audition with Les Koenig of Contemporary Records. Koenig had been alerted that Coleman's compositions, for all their oddities, might be suitable material for other players to record. At first, the audition faltered. Coleman was unable to perform his pieces on the piano, and in desperation he resorted to playing them on alto, backed by Cherry's pocket cornet. Koenig was fascinated by the music and set up a trial session with a full band, which in turn led to Coleman's first record date, Something Else, the Music of Ornette Coleman. Pianist Walter Norris described to me, in a 1990 interview, the peculiar preparations for the unconventional session. "We rehearsed two or three times a week for about 6 months leading up to the recording. A number of times we rehearsed at my house. I would take a paper and pen and make notes about the compositions and about what we were supposed to be doing. But the funny thing was that at every rehearsal, Ornette would change what we had done the last time. He would change the structure of the song or where the rubato was. And then, when we finally showed up for the record date, he changed everything again." Even before it was released, the Jazz Grapevine picked up on the coming event, with Downbeat promising that it would be very, very avant-garde. In retrospect, we can see that Something Else represents a less radical departure from the jazz tradition than both its critics and supporters claimed at the time. Conventional 32-bar and 12-bar structures are evident, and familiar chord changes, borrowed from standards such as I Got Rhythm and Out of Nowhere, underpin the solos. Moreover, Coleman's improvisations capture a modal flavor and only hint at the atonality of his later work. Yet the freshness of Coleman and Cherry's melodic lines stood out despite these remembrances of jazz past. It was as though the music had undergone an exemplary unburdening, as if all of the clichés and hoary riffs accumulated over a half-century of jazz music were thrown overboard, lightening the load and opening up the horizon. Coleman's star was clearly in the ascendancy. Influential patrons, including Gunther Schuller and John Lewis, befriended him and helped open doors. Coleman and Cherry were invited to attend the Lenox School of Jazz, ostensibly as students, but in fact serving as unacknowledged faculty members. Coleman got a regal welcome at the 1959 Monterey Jazz Festival where, in a program billed as The Three Saxes, he shared the stage with Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster. Earlier that same year, two follow-up recordings had been taped by different labels within a few weeks of each other, Tomorrow is the Question on Contemporary and The Shape of Jazz to Come on Atlantic. The Atlantic release stood out as an especially important statement of the new music. For the first time, Coleman was able to record using his working quartet of Cherry, Hayden, and Higgins. The breadth of their music was striking, ranging from the almost unbearably poignant Lonely Woman to the forceful Congeniality and the moody Peace. But the notoriety of these achievements paled beside the fierce debates ignited by the New York debut of the Ornette Coleman Quartet on the heels of the release of these two recordings. The band opened at the Five Spot on November 5, 1959, with interest running so high that the club took the rare step of offering a preview for the press and select members of the local jazz establishment. Some listeners walked out, others sat transfixed, and though there was no consensus among the audience, almost every opinion was adamant. Controversy proved good for business and for Coleman's career. His two-week gig was extended by 2 months. Visiting players clamored to sit in, with everybody from Leonard Bernstein to Lionel Hampton taking the plunge. Mainstream periodicals, including Newsweek and Harper's Bazaar, covered Coleman's arrival on the scene as a major cultural event, and jazz magazines seethed with heated exchanges. Anxious to capitalize on the Coleman phenomenon, Atlantic released Change of the Century the following June, drawing on tracks recorded shortly before the quartet left California. This was another intriguing project by the altoist, showing his skill in slyly referencing other idioms, the blues in Ramblin', bebop in Bird Food, and Latin music in Una Muy Bonita. The subtlety of these allusions was striking, and in each instance Coleman forced the other style into subservience to his freer approach. In the 9 months following the release of Change of the Century, Atlantic set up a number of additional recording sessions for their new star jazz artist. These featured several different facets of the altoist's work, including Coleman's follow-up efforts in a quartet setting, with Ed Blackwell replacing Higgins, and in larger ensembles conducted by Gunther Schuller. But the most daring project took place on December 21, 1960, when Coleman gathered together a double quartet at A&R Studios in New York. The resulting record, Free Jazz, represented a radical extreme even by the standards of Coleman's previous work. In the past, for all his nonconformism, Coleman had favored performances that retained elements of the jazz tradition. His incisive compositions were, for the most part, highly structured, melody statements encapsulated horn solos backed by rhythm section. A 4-4 sense of time predominated. Most pieces lasted around 4 or 5 minutes. Free jazz, in contrast, broke all these rules. Instead, it took on overtones of a spectacle, serving as a jazz equivalent of those battles royal favored by television wrestling aficionados, brutish encounters in which a number of well-toned bodies engage in simultaneous, extemporaneous sparring. Clearly, the talents gathered by Coleman for this session were heavyweights. 2 quartets were used, separated into the left and right channels of the stereo recording, with Coleman and Cherry, backed by Higgins and Scott LaFaro, countering the efforts of Eric Dolphy and Freddie Hubbard, supported by Hayden and Blackwell. The texture of the music was much thicker than earlier Coleman efforts. Churning and seething, sounds ricocheting between the 2 quartets, a relentless energy permeating the music. Free jazz fulfilled all the prophecies made about Coleman, both positive and negative. Devotees who had sought a sonic revolution in his work were not likely to be disappointed. This was radical music by any measure, a horn-playing assault that could bring down the walls of Jericho all over again. By the same token, those critics who wished to dismiss Coleman as a purveyor of cacophonous, jarring notes and tones, an exponent of shrill noise, found ample ammunition in free jazz to justify their attacks, seeing it as fulfillment of Shakespeare's descriptive sound and fury signifying nothing. Yet in the final analysis, Coleman's embrace of free-form energy jazz would prove to be prescient. Over the next several years, the work of Albert Ayler, Cecil Taylor, Pharoah Sanders, even John Coltrane, among others, would increasingly gravitate toward longer, uninhibited, loosely structured, often disturbing performances, explosions of sound that are much closer to free jazz than to any of Coleman's earlier works. In time, this very same approach would become a cliché of free jazz, with even the most impassioned atonal performances tending toward a certain somber sameness. But for at least the next decade, this subversion of the various jazz conventions, chord changes, tempos, song forms, structured solos, and the like, would retain its radical flavor and maintain its credentials as the most progressive strain in jazz. With free jazz, Coleman not only gave a fitting name to the movement, but effectively captured the essence of its sound. Coleman himself seemed increasingly ambivalent about the path he was now pursuing. Over the next 4 years, he would enter the recording studio on only a handful of occasions. 4 sessions for Atlantic in 1961 resulted in the release of Ornette and Ornette on Tenor, but during this period he made just a few public appearances. Coleman's sole recording during the following year documented his December 21, 1962 town hall concert, promoted by the altoist himself in response to his growing distrust of booking agents and club owners. This ambitious affair, which featured Coleman's trio along with a string quartet and several rhythm and blues players, barely broke even. For the next 2 years, Coleman disappeared almost completely from public view. This represented no resignation on Coleman's part, merely a tactical retreat. In private, the altoist formulated bold, at times grandiose plans. He decided to open his own jazz club and even selected a site. He planned to start his own music publishing company. But, like the town hall concert, these attempts to wrest control of the business side of his career met with little or no success. Coleman also aimed to expand his instrumental skills, but instead of embarking on formal saxophone study, he decided to learn trumpet, violin, and guitar. Meanwhile, he turned down offers to work as a bandleader, although around this same time he participated in high-profile jams with Cecil Taylor, Albert Ayler, and John Coltrane. Finally, in January 1965, Coleman returned to the bandstand, performing at New York's Village Vanguard, an engagement that, in retrospect, can be seen as initiating a second phase in his career, one that lasted for the next 8 years and would culminate in Coleman's collaboration with local musicians in Jujuka, Morocco. In place of the sharply focused altoist of his early work, now stood a restless musician running in many directions at once. Ornette the altoist, Ornette the trumpeter, Ornette the violinist, Ornette the serious composer, Ornette the explorer of world music, Ornette the jazz traditionalist, Ornette the theorist of harmonics. He was all of these and more. There were passing glances backward. His live recording at the Golden Circle in Stockholm, for example, recalled the focused energy of his work for the Atlantic label. But other efforts broke surprising new ground. He wrote Forms and Sounds for Woodwind Quintet. He was awarded his first Guggenheim Fellowship, a rare honor at that time, when jazz players seemed all but blacklisted from this prestigious award, which resulted in his orchestral work, Inventions of Symphonic Poems. His composition, Emotion Modulation, was performed on trumpet and violin, and found Coleman backed by two bassists, a drummer, and vocalist Yoko Ono. Coleman himself emerged as a vocalist, singing as part of a backup chorus on a Louis Armstrong album. Sun Suite of San Francisco was written for trumpet soloist Bobby Bradford, backed by Coleman's quartet and a 35-piece orchestra. Other pieces were composed for string quartet. The range of Coleman's new music was documented on a series of recordings, including The Empty Foxhole, New York Is Now, Science Fiction, and Skies of America. In the liner notes to the latter album, an ambitious project featuring the London Symphony Orchestra, Coleman first referred to harmonic theory. Harmonics, Coleman explained, was based on the use of melody, harmony, and the instrumentation of movement of forms. This doctrine would loom large in Coleman's public pronouncements during later years. As a theoretical approach, harmonics came to represent more a metaphysical doctrine than a musicological tool, a sort of Rosicrucianism for improvisers. And even the loose links with music theory were ultimately subverted by Coleman himself. He eventually came to insist that harmonics could help in almost any area of creative expression, including fiction and poetry. From the vagueness of Coleman's comments, one suspects that it could equally apply to bricklaying or the culinary arts. But the ultimate test of Coleman's artistry during this period was not as a theorist, but as a musician. On the heels of his harmonic philosophizing, Coleman began experimenting with new approaches to combo playing. For years, he had avoided hiring harmony instrument players, such as pianists or guitarists, for his band. But in the early 1970s, Coleman began an association with guitarist James Blood Ulmer. Ulmer brought a radically different texture to Coleman's ensemble, mixing free jazz with elements of funk, rock, and experimental electronic music. Bassist Jamaluddin Takume and drummer Ronald Shannon Jackson also became prominent Coleman sidemen, furthering the altoists' new direction with their hard-grooving, dance-oriented styles. The A&M release, Dancing in Your Head, revealed how far Coleman had come since free jazz. At the height of the fascination with jazz-rock fusion, Coleman showed that it was possible to use electric music as a springboard for improvisation without resorting to the overtly commercial, slickly streamlined sounds that were now drowning the jazz world in wave after wave of synthesized slush. Follow-up releases such as Body Meta and Of Human Feelings, built on this same approach, presented under the banner of Prime Time, a name chosen by Coleman to represent this facet of his music. This greater comfort playing with harmony instruments could also be seen in later Coleman projects, such as his Song X collaboration with Pat Metheny from 1985, his invitation to Jerry Garcia to join in Coleman's Virgin Beauty project from 1988, and his work with pianists Jerry Allen and Joaquin Kuhn in the mid-1990s. Coleman recorded little after this point, but his 2006 release, Sound Grammar, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Music, only the second time a jazz artist had received that honor. Cecil Taylor, whose influence on the free jazz movement would come to rival Coleman's, presents a stark contrast to the altoist. Where Coleman was self-taught and struggled to learn the rudiments of music theory, Taylor boasted a blue-ribbon musical education. Where Coleman drew much of his early inspiration from bebop, blues, R&B, and other African-American forms of music, Taylor called upon a wider range of influences, including contemporary classical composers such as Stravinsky and Bartok. The latter's use of Hungarian folk music in his compositions was seen by Taylor as a counterpart to his own relationship to the jazz tradition, and his tastes in jazz were notably expansive, ranging far beyond the reigning bop figures of his formative years, and spanning Fats Waller, Jimmy Lunsford, Chick Webb, Cab Calloway, Errol Garner, Dave Brubeck, Jackie Byard, Dick Twardzik, Horace Silver, and above all, Duke Ellington. Where Coleman's later works drew on popular dance styles with pronounced funk and rock elements, Taylor gravitated to formal dance, writing and performing original pieces for ballet artists and modern dance companies. Above all, Taylor's music, despite frequently being mentioned in the same breath as Coleman's, is cut from different cloth. It is denser, atomistic, more explosive, more insistently percussive, more thoroughly purged of romantic sentiment. In place of Coleman's human cry on the saxophone, one finds Taylor's fusillade of notes unforgiving and unapologetic. Born in Long Island City, New York in 1929, Taylor